Government, Subcommittee of the Subcommittee on General Government, to order. We're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5530 again. Today we've got a continuation of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's budget. We have a continuation of the agency overview. And first we're going to do agents' compensation. Here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory, Interim Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I'll just give you a very brief overview of agents' compensation this morning because you will be hearing directly from agents themselves. Just to briefly bring you up to date, we have contractor liquor agents who run all 238 liquor stores throughout the state. They're the front line in enabling the Liquor Commission to make the sales that fulfill its mission. Agents' commitment contribute to the livability and the safety of the communities they serve. Those folks are responsible for the $561 million in sales that we are forecasting for the 03-05 biennium. They handle and deposit all of those proceeds into state accounts. They manage average monthly inventories in their stores of $10.5 million in total at cost. And, of course, the state pays agents monthly for the services that they provide, and that is agents' compensation. From that, the agents pay all of their operating expenses, including all of their employee costs, their lease costs, any taxes, telephone, all of their expenses, insurance, electricity, city and county taxes, sick leave and vacation coverage for their employees. And then what they have left out of that is basically their gross pay, of which they have to pay their state taxes, their income taxes, save for retirement, vacation, sick, and health benefits. The governor's balanced budget has agents' compensation for 03-05 at close to $48 million. So, Mr. Chair, if you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that has occurred to me as I've watched the days go by and your presentation, in fact, the whole agency's presentation, and you've now touched on it by talking about the agents, is it seems to me that if the agents are responsible for selling $560 million worth of product, what I haven't seen, and maybe it's just I've missed it, is a merchandising plan or some relationship between the OLCC and the agents, some memorialized plan for marketing $560 million worth of sales. I'm making the assumption that retail is retail, whether you're selling clothes at Nordstrom's or a bottle of gin at the Uptown Liquor Store. And I need somebody to help walk me to that place where OLCC and the agents interface in figuring out how do you merchandise $560 million worth of sales. How do you promote new products? How do you let the public know what's for sale? How do you responsibly introduce into the system new things the same way that if there was some new line of shoes at Nordy's, there'd be a marketing plan surrounding the introduction of some fancy new line of shoes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, some of what you talked about we do have. It's encompassed in the Retail Operations Manual, which is a book that talks about how agents deposit and those kinds of things. But it also talks about such things as merchandising skills and shelf management and how you set your shelves so that when the customer comes in, they have their broad selection and how things are placed so it becomes a more profitable decision for the state when a customer goes to the shelf. In the Retail Operations Manual, a number of those things occur. As far as actual marketing plans, as to how we let all customers know that we have new products in the store, for instance, we really don't make that available. However, we are very interested in getting the price book that we shared with you up on our web. So our hope is that that will make a lot of the products which are available in the stores more available to those who are interested in taking a look at purchasing them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
I don't know to what degree you have given any thought to relying on the guidance of the private sector. I'm thinking about the very hot competition in grocery stores for where a product sits. And I'm thinking about the aggressive merchandising of some of the retail clothing. Is there a point where OLCC takes any external guidance to help retail a product? I know the dilemma you have is to retail it responsibly, because you're selling a product that has some social consequences, unlike a pair of shoes. But also some way to more aggressively take the lessons learned in the very competitive world of retail and help apply those to what ostensibly contributes pretty mightily to the state's coffers and generates $500 million in sales.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that point's well taken, and we do not do a tremendous amount as far as marketing. One of the things we do is we hire people who have extensive retail backgrounds to be our liquor agents, and we do that for a number of reasons, but certainly one of them is that marketing skill. Also, we have our distillery representatives who, of course, are in the marketing field every day, and they are out working with our liquor agents, building displays, putting the product of the month, if you will, in the correct spot in the store to be getting the best profitable sales for the state, because it's in their best interest, the agent's best interest, and, of course, the state's best interest. So we actually could probably do more along that line. We've talked about having classes that agents could participate in. We've not done that, but I think it's a conversation we could continue to have.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
Along those same lines.
I mean, I think one of the issues here is trying to, it's probably been the issue for the OLCC in its entire modern history, actually, is trying to balance those two things of encouraging responsible use and selling product. But along with Representative Johnson's comments in terms of, like, you know, I try to think about this dichotomy going back and forth. You say that some of your new stores have gotten better locations. But what would happen if you actually assisted your agents in moving many of your stores to better locations? I mean, in terms of your retail sales. And how would that butt up against your other... I just think it's kind of a dilemma. I guess this budget year we'd like you to probably, or this biennial period, we'd like you to generate as much revenue as possible. But at the same time, I'm still wondering, you know, you have a product, there's a market for the product, but you're kind of like hidden in the sense, you know, you're not out there really marketing the product. I think your agents, aren't they under some restrictions in terms of, they may not even have the resources, obviously, too, but they can't go out and market their stores openly, can they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we have just initiated some new rulemaking at the Commission regarding advertising, and that will open up not only some advertising for the distillery reps to more effectively advertise the products, but also liquor agents.
Yeah.
Up until now, liquor agents could only have a very small ad, for instance, in a generally read population periodical. And actually, a number of liquor agents are having quite nicely larger ads with little decorations on them in magazine or in newspaper magazines, if you will, that really don't meet our rules. So we're opening up the rules to allow these kinds of things. You mentioned the revenue, and we absolutely agree with you. We would like to put forward as much revenue as possible, and that is why we have in our retail business plan, you know, the goals for adding new stores. And the new stores that we're adding are being added in areas that are in shopping centers that are very open to the public. You know, they're not, the stores are not getting hidden in the back. In the back corners. The other issue is, while we would like to be very proactive with liquor agents, we have very few staff. We only have 4 people that work with the liquor agents in the 238 stores. So while we would really like to work with agents, too, to find better locations and to move existing stores into better locations, it's pretty difficult when you've got, you know, each person with about 4 or 50 stores per person to work with.
Another follow-up,
Senator.
This is a different type of question, is that in terms of insurance for agents, what is the situation there in terms of liability? Does the state have liability? Obviously, there's still a state connection with the store. They're an agent. What is the situation for agents in terms of basically obtaining liability insurance? Because many areas for liability insurance rates have gone up incredibly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, most agents do have liability insurance themselves, and perhaps when they come and speak, they can talk more to that.
Okay.
But the agents also are, at least Department of Justice believes that they are covered under the state tort liability.
Okay.
So they have coverage there, too. Now, that has never gone to court, so it's never actually been tested. But Department of Justice believes that agents are covered as state employees are covered under tort liability.
Thank you. Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The exchange that you just had with Senator Devlin prompted me to come back to a question that I've already asked, but I'm going to ask it one more time in a different way. You said you only had four staff that work with the agents, and yet in your proposal, you're cutting those folks that are in the licensing department and able to do the customer kind of relationship. You're keeping enforcement whole, as I see it. And I know I'm mixing apples and oranges slightly here. But the point that I'm trying to make is, to the degree that you're able to work with agents, able to work with establishments, able to work with servers, it seems to me that by forging a better relationship on that end, you diminish the need for increased enforcement. And I am still, before the hearing is over, struggling with why it is that enforcement stays whole and those parts of your business that are the interface with the people actually selling product in all of their different iterations and layers, why it is that you're making the business decision to cut on that end, keeping the enforcement piece whole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there are two reasons for that. First of all, the licensing people really only deal with the business people, as you mentioned, when they first come into the process. Our licensing folks go through the investigation, take a look at everything that the new licensee is planning on doing, and they are the folks that get them into the business. But the person in the regulatory side of the business who is going to have the continuous relationship with the licensee is actually the enforcement folks. Those are the people who go out and do the visits. Those are the people who go out and have the ongoing relationships. And our mission, the primary piece of our mission, is public safety, and that's why the agency chose not to cut those folks.
That might be a decision that I hope before we're done we revisit. I was in a highly regulated industry for 20 years, the helicopter business. The FAA came to be my friend. You know, we're here from the government, we're here to help you. I always knew when they walked into my maintenance facility, they were regulators. And the piece that I'm trying to understand, going back to my question about helping with marketing, the relationship that you have with the people doing your business, I keep looking for some indication that the OLCC has a way of doing business that helps on this end, not on the enforcement end. And I just am continuing to look for that demonstration that whether it's your partners, the agents, or ostensibly your partners, the licensees, or your partners wherever that are dispensing a product that yields $500 million in revenue, I'm just looking for reassurance that there are relationships outside of the regulatory realm where you're trying to help folks do the state's business.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I guess if we could bifurcate the agency just for a minute. And the merchandising side, the district representatives are actually work and helpmates with the agents. And I think that if you ask them today, they would probably have, I think that they would depict their relationship with the district representatives in the merchandising area to be that. They are not regulatory folks. They do, educate liquor agents as far as the laws that they need to follow. but that side of the business is really much more of a relationship situation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions for Karen? Thank you, Karen. Let's see. Your capital improvement program overview, very quickly.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I might have Merle Lindsay come up quickly.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Before they move off the agents piece, you asked that I do a little investigation on the compensation.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, please.
And could I ask Mr. O'Connor to come up to the table?
You bet.
He has a handout that I think is extremely illustrative and will help us understand the AB compensation schedule. I would like to share with you that the OLCC folks made a special effort to come to my office and were very responsive and couldn't have been more helpful. And once they laid out for me the chart that's up on the wall, I think it's very clear that the AB was really, the way it was explained to me, done to accommodate agent preference. And that while it is a bit anomalous that you have these two schedules, following my question about why they didn't just get rid of one of them and make the compensation standardized, the response that I got was this was done to allow maximum flexibility to the agent. So I think this is the agency being responsive. And I'd ask Mr. O'Connor to walk through this because I think it will become very clear that there are not two sets of compensation, but there are two methodologies for delivering that compensation. The agents paid the same amount for the same gross sales, but in just a slightly different format, and that the agents have the election of the A schedule or the B schedule. A is phasing itself out over time, and I'll leave that to Mr. O'Connor to elaborate.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thank you for hosting that question yesterday in that work group. Mr. O'Connor?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael O'Connor. I'm the Acting Director of Fiscal Services for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And actually, Representative Johnson pretty much explained an awful lot of it. Really, what we have are the two different schedules is primarily a timing difference between when the folks get paid. Most of our agents are now in Schedule B, and basically they work for a month. We determine what their compensation is. We pay them for that compensation. They work another month. We pay them for that compensation. Back when we first started getting liquor agents as opposed to state employees, we wanted to be able to help those agents with the initial operating cash. So we, in essence, gave them an advance, a salary advance for a month. It was based on the previous month's sales. After that point, they work a month, they get paid a month, work a month, get paid a month, until the very end of their tenure, at which time they either retire or leave the system. And it's at that point that there's a slight delay, which you can see in January. We don't pay them in December because we have to wait and find out what those final sales are for that last month. And it's at that point that we then catch up that agent so that in the end, both B schedule and A schedule have been paid the same amount of money.
Are there questions of Mr. O'Connor, how that sorts out? Thank you again, Representative Johnson. Let me just ask one question, Mr. O'Connor, and that is, I assume that you're providing 1099 NECs on these, the exhibit that we've been provided with. Are there 2 years involved here relative to the 1099s, 1 year for everything except January of the second year?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Actually, we provide 1099s based on cash basis.
Okay.
You know, for all cash that's paid in that year, a 1099 is generated. So under the circumstance, since the A agent was paid in the subsequent year, there'd actually be two 1099s generated.
Okay, good. Thank you very kindly. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you
again. And now moving on quickly to capital improvement program. Merle?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Merle Lindsay, Director of Administrative Services Division. And I'll give you a quick overview of the capital improvement system here this morning. As you know, the Liquor Commission owns its facility up in Milwaukee, which is our warehouse and our office facility. This complex was built in 1954, and it's had two additions since then. One, in 1977, we expanded our warehouse by 13,000 square feet to its present size of 124,000 square feet. And secondly, our office was expanded in the 89-91 period to its present 40,000 square feet. The Liquor Commission, as you know, the warehouse, it's where we do our receiving. It's a central warehouse. We do our receiving, storing, and shipping of our liquor product. In our capital improvement area, we have a 10-year perpetual plan, and that's listed in your book under the capital improvements. We look at those smaller, medium-sized maintenance projects that we do on an annual basis, and we have a 10-year projection of those things that we will deal with to maintain this facility and keep it operating and functioning. Last biennium, the Liquor Commission asked for and received ongoing funding in our capital improvement area. We received about $201,000. And with this money, we take care of these mid-sized projects, the maintenance and repair projects of the Commission. When we'll have a larger size project, it'll follow the normal budget process, for instance, such as a roof repair. It's well beyond the $200,000 limitation that we currently have here, and it'll follow the policy option package process and come before you.
Other questions of Mr. Lindsay? Thank you very much for that brief report. And we do have the responses from questions raised by the subcommittee. Karen, do you need to spend any special time with us on those? We have those in our packets.
I don't think so, Mr.
Okay. Chair. It appears that they're self-explanatory. And so with that, we do have a rather lengthy list here. And we're going to start with Jackie Chase coming from out of town. I believe she comes all the way from Eastern Oregon. Jackie?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Jackie Chase. I'm from Richland, Oregon, way over there. I got in about 9 o'clock last night. And I understand that there's been some talk in the last couple of days about the server education program. I'm with Advanced Training, and I teach one of the I teach the classes around the state of Oregon for the OLCC program for server education. And we heard that there was going to be a couple of positions cut from the server education staff. And so I had emailed Representative Butler and let him know that the program is self-supporting, and so the funds come from, you probably have this, but I brought them just in case, the service permit application that's given to all of the people that are going to serve alcohol around the state of Oregon, and they pay the $23 fee, and of that $23 fee, the $13 goes to the server education program. And then I had put in a letter to Representative Butler that ORS 471341 and ORS 471542 clearly state that the fees are for the running and staffing of the server education program. So I guess my question is why the staff cuts to server education when they aren't from the general fund or from, well, they're from taxpayers, of course, the people that come through the programs. But so I sent the model curriculum to Representative Butler. I don't, or had OLCC. Did you get that for the program?
I have a copy, and I'm sorry I didn't bring
right.
down my paper.
And I brought along our workbook, which is just the outline of what the legislative session in 1985, what they wanted being taught. If you wanted that, but. So basically, that's why I drove all the way over here, was because this program is very important, and I think the integrity of the program is at stake if we lose these two positions.
We've had some testimony from the agency regarding it, that if they cut back and make the efficiencies and reduce the folks, then they reduce the price and everything decreases. But is there any indication that we're not getting the water to the end of the row with the $13 fee and the $10 server education training and the $10 fee?
Well, Mr. Chair,
everybody getting trained?
Yes, everybody is getting trained, but I think what we need the two staff people for is if there isn't someone out there making sure that there's many, many instructors out there. And the problem that we had in the beginning when we didn't have staff helping us out was these people, they would go out and teach an hour and a half hour program and not really cover all the things that were required. And so this just keeps the standards of the program up. So I think we really need to. And when we make a phone call to OLCC and we have our two or three staff people there, they're wonderful about getting back to us. I mean, I've called them in the middle of a class and ask a question and...
Excellent.
And they get back to me. So.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people like you are there that are teaching these classes?
Do you know, I meant to call and get that information. We have...
Give me a guess.
I guess people teach, 30 Can someone throw in 30 instructors or somewhere around there? So we have the private sector and the community colleges are who the providers for the program.
Let me get Linda Ignowski to come forward and identify herself for the record and help us out.
For the record, I'm Linda Ignowski, the Regulatory Program Director. And, Mr. Chair, there's about 50 instructors and 25 providers.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions?
Well, I think one of the questions came from me about if OLCC was out of the training business entirely and it was done by private sector providers, how would that work as far as getting people trained? And I think your testimony has spoken to that, that you need the coordination function at the OLCC to standardize curricula and to make sure all the instructors are up to speed on changes in the law. Is that what you're telling us?
That is it, Representative Johnson. And the OLCC does not teach server education. Did I misunderstand? It is...
I know that they don't teach it, but they have a coordination function.
Indeed. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay.
The question that I was originally asking was, why was OLCC in server education at all? Couldn't that all be put out into the private sector? And if I've understood you correctly, that coordination function back at the head office that keeps all 50 of you that are out teaching this, whether it's an individual practitioner or a community college, that coordination feature is important to you.
That's exactly it.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Ms. Chase?
Thank you very much, Jackie, for
Thank
coming
you.
All the way over from Richland
yes,
to take some of this moisture back and put it into the mountains.
Yeah,
and
I left
back
70
home.
Degrees in sunshine.
It's too early for 70 degrees in sunshine
oh,
in
see.
The valley. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Mary Blackman, and with Mary, we've got Marjorie Taylor and Carol Reese. Are you going to use an acronym?
I just know that before this is over, I'm going to say AFSCME. You know, I just know that... Mr. Chair, I know I'm going to do this, so I'm just going to pay in advance.
Okay, thank you very much. The American Cancer Society thanks you, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 75. And we represent roughly 200 folks who work for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I want to emphasize that it is the Control Commission. It is not the Consumption Commission. And that's an important distinction because I think that, you know, when we look at this, we have to look at it and say, what is the job of the commission? We represent an agency that makes a lot of money for the state of Oregon. And we want to do more. We want to make more. We know, you know, I can go to any budget committee meeting anywhere right now and try and figure out where to find money. You know, this is an agency that we want to maximize the return on our investment with. And every dollar that we can save is potential dollars for the general fund. We know that. Our members see their job as one to promote the responsible use of alcohol by responsible adults, to keep alcohol out of the hands of minors as much as possible. They do a pretty good job. It's an effective, efficient agency. They do more with less. You know, I was stunned when I knew that we had faced cuts. The chart that goes like this was astounding to me. You know, it is one of those things where as I look at the work that our members do out there, you know, you don't see a lot of idle hands when you go out to the agency. I had the honor of sitting with Representative Johnson on the task force, and I kind of went into the task force with the idea that my job there was to make sure that somebody didn't come up with some crazy idea of privatizing the agency, and about halfway through realized that really what my job there was to make sure that the agency was being responsive to the needs of the consumer, the agents who are moving the product, to make sure that our members had what they needed to effectively and efficiently move product out to the agents and at the same time to regulate the industry. It is a challenge and a balancing act that is incredible. All you have to do, I was thinking 10 days ago I was sitting in judiciary over in the Senate, and there's nothing quite as sobering, you'll excuse the pun, as sitting through 2 hours of testimony by parents of murdered children, all of which are there because their children were murdered by drunk drivers. And the drunk drivers were not convicted of murder. They were convicted of assault. And Representative Patridge, you know this. They got DUIs. And so I'm listening to these parents who now have a bill in to make a stiffer penalty for vehicular homicide. Then I go down to the state police budget, and I listen to the state police talking about eliminating the positions of the folks who make sure that the breathalyzer testing equipment is functional and accurate. I listen to the DAs talk about their frustration over not being able to prosecute because the data that they have and the testing that they have may or may not be accurate. And then I come here and I think, okay, and we're going to cut more. We had 8,000 friendly visits with our agents. 8,000 in 2 years. That is 77 a week. We have 35 inspectors and however many investigators. This is an incredible workload for these folks, and they do it with very little complaint. We think of this as a partnership with you as legislators to maximize our profits, but at the same time, we need to restore enough staff so that we can do better for you and so that we can produce higher profits for you by more efficiently opening the stores. Marjorie Taylor and Carol Reese, who are with me today. Carol is one of our licensed investigators, and Marjorie is the president of our local out there. And they're going to talk a little bit more in detail about what specifically they do. But we just want to kind of wrap up by saying that we think this is a great agency, that it's a good agency to work with. We have a good relationship with them. We have very few labor issues that arise there that can't be dealt with in a kind of a passive partnership way. And I'm going to close by telling you a story. I have a friend, a very close personal friend, worked in this building for 18 years. Worked for the Senate, for the governor. She worked for our union for 7 years. When she left our union, she went into a partnership with another friend to buy an existing restaurant and bar in Portland. When they purchase the bar, there's a whole transition that has to occur with licensing and server education and all of the things that you have to go through to get your liquor license transferred from the previous owner to them. They had to go through this with OLCC and with the lottery. With OLCC, they did not lose one day of serving time. Not one minute, not one moment was lost in their serving time. They lost no profits at the bar. Nearly 10 weeks later, they have been through not one but two investigations with the lottery. The lottery has lost the paperwork not once, not twice, not three times, but four times. They still don't have their video poker machines back online. And finally, in absolute, total, and complete frustration, they unplugged the lottery machines, hoping that they would get somebody's attention, because when you unplug them, a bell or a whistle or a light or something goes off at the lottery commission saying, oh, my God, something's wrong. It took 4 days for them to get a return call after they unplugged the machines. You know, Mr. Chair, you know I have plans. And you know I don't have a lot of legs under those plans. But I'm thinking that long term, we need to figure out how we run these two agencies like we run OLCC. And we do it in a way that makes more money for people, more money for the state, and provides the services that we need, the regulation that we need, and cuts down on the duplication and the harassment that bar and restaurant owners are going through by one agency when, you know, when they started this process. My friend told me that, she goes, you know, I always hated OLCC. I always hated them until I had to deal with them. And she goes, dealing with them has been a dream in comparison to dealing with anybody else. And, you know, we just encourage you to really think about how we restore some positions, continue to maximize the money that we're putting into the general fund. And with that, I'm going to close, and I'm going to stay here and let these ladies who are very nervous talk to you. And if they say apps me, I'll put dollars in for them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marjorie Taylor, and as Mary mentioned, I am president of our local 2505 at the Liquor Commission. I am also the training specialist at the Liquor Commission, so I spend a lot of time going around all areas of the Liquor Commission. I'm here today to address, on my own time, two areas, the represented staff and our cost-cutting efforts. First, we have a great group of people working at the commission. When I came to the commission about 4 years ago, I was impressed by the commitment to our mission and goals that I saw in our staff. They are workers vitally dedicated to serving the people of Oregon and fulfilling our mission. Many of them have been with the agency for years. They are committed to our mission and goals. They care for the very customers they serve, whether it's the store owner, the restaurant owner, the customer, the neighbor, or the people of Oregon. The partnerships they have formed with police departments, city management, and neighborhood groups are a point of pride among our staff. Another impressive area is the good relations between management and staff. Our union has rarely had to step in to settle issues because they just aren't there. However, lately I've seen a change in the atmosphere at the commission. There are tears, and our morale is going down. People seem to be on edge. They're beginning to be moody and snappy. Why? The workload increases. The uncertainties. Today we have 50 fewer staff than we did in the 80s. And I don't have to tell you that the population of the state has increased. Since I've been at the commission, I've been impressed with the workload the staff has handled, whether it's in the warehouse, in licensing, or in compliance. They all work together, they work hard, and they work smart. Carol Reese will tell you how her workloads in licensing have changed over the last year. Second thing I want to talk about is our agency produces income, but yet we are making efforts to maximize the return on investment for Oregonians. For over a year now, we have been very active in cost-cutting measures as if we were a general fund agency. We have no overtime. We limit our driving. We recycle paper into our copiers. We dim the lights in our hallways and offices. We bundle up in sweaters and blankets to stay comfortable. And we empty our own trash and vacuum our own workspaces. We really want to do our work, but it keeps getting more and more difficult. In closing, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the state of Oregon are privileged to have such a dedicated workforce. Our mission is to effectively regulate the sale of distribution and responsible use of alcoholic beverages in order to protect Oregon's public health, safety, and community livability. I fear that we will not be able to fulfill that mission if we cannot replace the people who have retired or the positions that will be cut.
Thank you very much, Marjorie. Appreciate it. Questions for Marjorie? Please go ahead, Carol.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reese, and I'm a licensed investigator in the regulatory division of the OLCC. 11 positions are targeted to be cut from the regulatory division. 3 of those are licensed investigators. At present, vacant positions are not being filled. I'm here before you today to express my concerns about proposed cuts in personnel, the possible loss of vacant positions, and the subsequent effects on OLCC, its employees, and the public. Although I'm very grateful to still be employed, coworkers and I have already been significantly impacted due to the vacant positions that are not being filled. We are all trying to make do with fewer people doing the work generated by those positions. I understand that everyone is having to take on more work during this economic crisis. However, I don't see how we can be expected to continue taking on more and more work with fewer and fewer employees. We will be losing positions while the workload increases. I've been doing license investigations for approximately 10 years. During the first 5 years of that time, I was carrying about 18 to 20 license application investigations. Then we had an increase in applications, and it rose to about 30 or so. Thankfully, that trend decreased for a while. However, in about mid-2001, there was another increase in license applications, and it hasn't slowed down since. In fact, as recently as April of 2002, I have routinely been carrying a caseload of 40 to 50 applications. And I'm not alone. All investigators are carrying huge workloads. Where there used to be 9 investigators handling the Metro Portland area, Washington County, Clatsop County, Clackamas County, Hood County, Tillamook, and Columbia counties, there are now 7 of us, and one of those is being filled by a temporary employee. When applicants ask me now how long it will take to get their liquor license, I'm telling them it could be 3 to 4 months. In the past, I would have told them 6 to 8 weeks. I've always prided myself and our agency on our ability to provide excellent customer service. And even though I still make the time to promptly return phone calls, that's one of my particular things that I have a pet peeve about, other duties I fear may be suffering. The consequence is that it's taking more time to process applications and get liquor licenses issued. With my commitment to customer service, I find that very troubling. Also, longer processing and issuing time means some businesses may not be operating at full capacity when they want to. That means they may not be making as much money, which in turn means money is not being put back into the state's economy. Everyone loses. As you are aware, being a state employee means you are always in the public's eye. We know that putting our best foot forward is of utmost importance. With fewer employees attempting to do the work generated by unfilled vacancies or lost positions, maintaining professional standards and performing well for the public we serve will become more and more difficult. We all want to do our best to provide excellent customer service. In closing, ours is a small agency. Any cuts will have a profound effect on how the work gets done. We cannot afford to leave positions vacant. We cannot afford to lose unfilled positions. We cannot afford additional cuts in personnel. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Carol. Representative Johnson, did you have a question?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. Let me just ask this. Has computerization helped you a great deal? It used to be that we typed a lot of letters and used carbon copies.
I remember those times. It has helped in getting reports written more quickly, yes.
And in the process of following up on your investigation, I assume you use this computer equipment that we've got.
We are getting more programs into our computer system that allow us access to more licensing matters.
Okay.
And there is a program being generated right now on that.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate you
coming
today.
Thank you.
Most instructive. Let's see, Gary Conklin from the Oregon Wine Growers Association. And on deck we'll have Vance and George and Marshall. So, Gary?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me appear today. For the record, I'm Gary Conklin, representing the Oregon Wine Growers, which consists of more than 200 Oregon wineries and now more than 300 separate Oregon vineyards. There actually are more wineries and vineyards than that. In fact, we may now have as many as 500 vineyards in this state. Jim Bruneau, who's the president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, would have been here today. Unfortunately, he's on the East Coast making sales calls and showing his wines to distributors. He's in New Haven, and so I've been communicating with him by email, and I have some of his remarks today, and I have prepared remarks, which I will leave for you after I'm done. I'm here principally to talk a little bit about the privilege tax and that portion of it which goes to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board. But if I may, just before I preface this, since this is a budget hearing relating to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, just let you know that the Oregon wine industry enjoys a good relationship with this agency. The chair has been particularly engaged with our industry, and we respect and appreciate his interest as that of the entire commission. The staff has been very accessible, and we enjoy a good working relationship with the agency. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that today. We are glad to have them as our partners. With respect to the privilege tax, the 2 cents of the 67 cents per gallon that goes to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, what this is a part of an arrangement that was developed and approved by the Oregon legislature to help Oregon's wine industry become, in fact, what it has developed into now is a major value-added agricultural crop in the state. And it has worked. Oregon today has the second largest number of wineries of any state in the country. And we have become the fourth largest producer. And we have done that even though we have, by anybody's comparisons, small wineries. The largest of our wineries, if you put them side by side with a winery in California, would look like almost sort of the back, skunk works. We're still a small-driven industry that works on a business model of selling quality wines at premium prices because we're low-volume producers. We're not in the high-volume market. We don't produce enough grapes, nor do we have enough capacity to be in that marketplace.
Now, when you say that you're the low-volume producer, and yet Oregon is the second-largest producer,
yeah,
is that in terms of dollars as opposed to production and pounds?
Mr. Chairman, it is in terms of amount, but it comes from lots of small producers. And when you think of some of the big producer states, such as California, New York, and Washington, it's easy to quickly think of the names that roll off your tongue. They're big wineries. We don't have any big wineries that are our flagships. Our biggest wineries, like I say, would be considered at the low end of the medium size in other states, if not, in fact, small wineries in other states.
But we are the second largest producer,
right,
and we have the second largest number of wineries in the country.
Yes, that's correct. Fourth largest producer and the second...
Fourth largest producer.
Right,
okay.
By volume, and second in terms of numbers.
All right, thank you.
Now, as to the money itself, the 2 cents is combined with a tonnage tax that's levied at $25 per ton on Oregon-grown wine grapes. This was the other part of the deal. According to Jim, this is the highest tonnage tax, grape tonnage tax, of any industry sector in the country. And what these funds combine to do is to provide money for our research activities, viticultural and enological research, almost all of which is conducted by Oregon State University. The other portion of the funds goes to promoting Oregon wine. And if I could just give you a simple example, the Oregon Wine Advisory Board makes a $40,000 contribution to something known as the Oregon Pinot Camp, where top wine buyers are invited. Sounds like a great thing. And by the way, they haven't invited me there. I don't know if this makes me have to pay this fine or not. It's not an acronym, but it's a commercial, I guess.
Sort of like a, I don't know. I think commercials were a lot more, as I recall.
That sounds like a ten, Mr. Chair, a $10 maybe.
Yeah.
Let me return to my testimony. Or I talked myself into that problem. But in any case, we bring in wine buyers from around the country, and the whole idea is to really help them taste, see Oregon wines, and always in combination with other Oregon-grown products, agricultural products. That's how we market our wines, as a complement to food. Each winery that participates pays a fee of $3,000 and helps further underwrite visitor expenses. While they're here, we also have these wine buyers go to Oregon restaurants. They're staying in some of our premier lodging facilities. So we use it as a tourist opportunity. And increasingly, Oregon wine is becoming part of how our state sells tourism and, in some cases, even other agricultural products. It's interesting to note on the new Lufthansa flights between Portland and Frankfurt, they will feature Oregon wine, because for them, that's a signature product of this state.
I just have a question, and you and I talked about this the other day. I want to make certain that the amounts that we're talking about relative to the 2 cents of the privilege tax that goes to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, 2 cents of the 67 cents, is all that OLCC collects. You've also talked about the $2 per ton on grape production. That's a commodity issue that doesn't really affect the OLCC, is it?
It's collected by the industry, and it's my understanding that it is collected by the OLCC.
Yeah, okay. Merle, what's the dollar amount that you collect and remit through in this budget? I haven't, in going through our book, I haven't seen it. And it's not on any of the flow charts as to where it comes in or goes out. Just for 2 cents per 67.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Merle Lindsay, Director of Administrative Services again. The $25 tonnage tax that we're talking about here is just a pass-through tax.
So it's $25 per ton?
Per ton. It's collected by the Liquor Commission and passed directly to the Wine Advisory Board.
No administration, just... And who supervises it? Who audits it?
The collection and the auditing occurred through our Fiscal Services Department. The Oregon Liquor Commission.
So the Oregon Liquor Commission Fiscal Services audits the $2 or the $25 per ton on the grapes, making sure that they've. Is there some? I assume that there must be some sort of a nexus between the $25 per ton on grapes and the amount of alcohol produced out of the operation at the other end?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. When our auditor is out in the field or in the office, we do this in conjunction with the wine tax audit itself. So we're looking at the production of that particular winery and its relationship to the $25 tons that they should be paying to the Wine Advisory Board.
Is there any other that you're aware of, Mr. Lindsay, is there any other commodity tax that's charged and filtered through a state agency other than the commodity commissions themselves?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, actually, I can help answer that question.
Let me just ask one more question in this regard. There was a figure the other day that was used of $366,000. Can you break that down for me as to how much of that is the $25 per ton and how much of that's the 2 cents?
Mr. Chairman, I can do that for you. The $366,000 was the 2 cents per gallon tax.
Oh, the 366 is
that's separate. That's okay. That's unique to the 2 cents per gallon. And because the $25 fee that is collected is just a pass through, it has no impact on our distribution to the state.
Do we give expenditure limitation on that additional $25? Does the Ways and Means process give expenditure, or is it continuously appropriated out to the wine advisory board?
I believe it is. Mr. Chair,
members of the committee, we don't, it's not touching the budget at all, either in the revenues or the expenditure area. But the question I think is asking, is it going through the state treasury before you pass it on to the...
Mr. Chairman, it is going through the state treasury.
And your employees that are handling the money, they're not charging the wine advisory board for that handling?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct as well. There's no fee charged to the Wine Advisory Board for these accounting services, if you will.
I'm really, really confused, because if it goes to the Treasury and this agency is cutting a check, somewhere it's got to be appropriated.
Are you collecting it in statutorily allowed to collect this money, or are you just doing it...
I believe that in Chapter 473, which is the beer and wine tax statute, is where it's talked about there.
And it's continuously appropriated, and it's not. It's a non-limited item.
Okay, yeah. So if it's continuously appropriated, then at some point the Ways and Means process probably sees it, but we don't pass judgment on its receipt or its disbursement. Okay, I needed to know that the $366 was separate from the $25 per ton. It is $25 per ton, not $2 per ton.
$25.
$25. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, back to the question you asked about other commodity commissions. As you and I, in our personal one-on-one conversation yesterday, as I indicated, the Oregon Wine Advisory Board is somewhat unique. Actually, it is unique among the commodity commissions. An issue that has been sort of brought into relief by legislative action this session, where the commodity commissions are dealing with their voluntary assessments and issues that have arisen involving free speech. We are not part of that particular issue, largely because we have statutorily created assessment vehicles for the same purposes that the commodity commissions have voluntary assessments. We made a decision some time ago and asked the legislature, and that's how these came into place and what purpose they've served. I might note, just in conclusion, that our own industry has legislation that is pending as well, House Bill 3442, it has been introduced by Representative Doyle, and I believe will go to House Rules, that deals with the evolution of the Oregon Wine Advisory Board to the Oregon Wine Board. This is the result of more than a year's worth of consensus building that has involved the Oregon Department of Agriculture and others, but mostly to try to find a way to get all of the industry around our state from all of the different viticultural regions to agree on an organizational structure that will help the industry deal with the very real problem that it has of competing against very aggressive marketing by other areas. Our Southern Oregon wineries in particular are having difficulty in the marketplace, and for the first time ever, Oregon wineries lost market share in our own state. The Oregon Wine Board will have a board appointed by the governor, and we're hopeful that legislation will move through. It, as a successor to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, would be the agency that would then administer the funds for research and marketing that we're talking about here.
Okay, I appreciate knowing that, but even though it becomes the Oregon Wine Board, it still does some advisory work amongst the growers and producers.
It will have many of the same functions, in fact, all of the same functions as the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, the two primary ones of which are really overseeing the research, the enological and viticultural research, and the promotion of the industry.
Not being familiar with 3442, will that raise then the wine board to the level of the Beef Council or the Wheat Growers League or those other folks? Is that what it's to do here?
Mr. Chairman, that's fundamentally what it is designed to do.
All right. Excellent. Other questions for Mr. Conklin? Thank you very much. Just one final question. When was the 2 cents imposed originally, Gary? When was the first tax imposed that went through to the advisory board?
Mr. Chairman, I knew you were going to ask me that question, and I asked Jim Bruneau that question, and he couldn't remember, and therefore
so
of course, I wasn't
Jim
born
Bruneau.
Yet. So, 1983. So there we
all
go.
Right. That's older than I am. All right, great. Thank you very much. Not really representing Johnson. I'm.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. You're welcome. Let's see. We've got Vance and George and Marshall Kova. Folks could come up. And you're all sitting together. Are you all talking?
I have those together.
Sure.
No,
thank you.
You guys are going to use some acronyms, huh? Okay.
Well, I'm Mr. Rotary, so this will be cheap.
We appreciate it. American Cancer Society appreciates it, too. Representative Johnson is the keeper of the acronyms over here, so she'll signal when we get enough.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marshall Kova, representing the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. I've handed out some written testimony. I'm just going to read a couple of the paragraphs, and then we'll get to George Coupler from the Oak Grove Liquor Store and Vance Burkhart from the 10th Avenue store in Portland. Thank you for this opportunity to present our two top priorities for the 2003 session. First of all, however, I'd like to thank the testimony that we had yesterday, which was a very impressive lineup. Senator Hannon, he came in and supported our top two priorities, which is an increase in agent compensation and moving the agent compensation to a non-limited expense item. Chair Lang, who also supported the same two items, and Mayor Drake from the Interim Committee and the Interim Committee's work, which supported an increase in agent compensation. We appreciate all of their efforts and words of support. Our top two priorities are exactly the same. First, we propose a change to the governor's recommended budget for the Liquor Control Commission of an increase of $5.385 million in additional agent compensation. This would be accomplished by increasing our average reimbursement from 8.54% to 9.5%. And secondly, we propose agent compensation be changed to a non-limited expense to eliminate the need for emergency board or Ways and Means Committee approval each time we exceed sales projections. These two proposals will ensure the continued improvement in retail liquor sales in Oregon and offer us the certainty that, in fact, our efforts to increase sales will be rewarded. We believe the sales numbers are very clear. As the portal between the public and the product, we have been successful in surpassing the L103 projections and are optimistic that with appropriate incentives, we can reach the 8% increase in sales projected for 0305. Much of the increased sales can be traced to the commitments made by agents to fulfill the goals outlined in the booklet, A Retail Business Plan for the Year 2000 and Beyond, which has been discussed, and I believe it's in your packet. But this document describes retailing goals, including improving shopping opportunities, friendly and attractive environments, improved customer service, and maintaining high profitability to benefit state and local governments. As business people, we realize that investing in better locations with longer, more convenient hours and a knowledgeable and helpful staff will benefit all the partners in liquor retailing. We also expect that our partners will allow us to reap the benefits of the appropriate business investment risk and with an appropriate business return. To summarize, we request your support for the long overdue increase in agent compensation. Since 1992, we have had a very small 4% increase, which was from 8.2% to 8.54%. So that's over the last 11 years, a small 4% increase in compensation rate, while the business costs, such as insurance, rent, employee payroll costs, even electricity, have far exceeded this increase. It is our goal that beginning July 1, 2003, we have passed a proposal that guarantees liquor agents an increased compensation rate and a non-limited budgeting process. We look forward to working with Chair Butler and the committee to find a solution to these issues so that we can continue to exceed projections and generate significant revenues for state and local programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marshall. Why don't we just go ahead, George, you're going to continue on.
I will. Good morning, Chairman Butler, members of the committee. I'm George Coupler. I'm the agent of the Oak Grove Liquor Store, 3 miles south of the headquarters of the OLCC. I'm a board member of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. I'd like to take a minute We'll give you a brief summary of this organization, this association. Early last year, the original organization saw a need for some changes. They had not accomplished much in a number of years for agents' benefits. At that time, early last year, there was 11 members. To date, we now have 107 members. We've focused our attentions. We have a new mission statement. We've changed our name. And we've taken, I think, a very positive direction. We have a very simple mission statement, and I will read it to you. It's not long. To create an environment that facilitates clear, concise, open, and accurate communication between agents, OLCC staff, the commissioners, vendors, and legislative bodies to promote agents' awareness and channel positive and constructive improvements and involvement for all agents. At our annual meeting last October, the organization made a commitment to hire a lobbyist to help us focus our attentions. We were fortunate to secure the services of Marshall Koba. He brings directness, integrity, and valued experience to our organization, and it truly has kept us on a focused task. A little about me. Some folks call me the numbers guy. I've been an agent for 3 years. I have been involved in the industry for about 5 years. Prior to that, I spent 20 years in the banking industry, hence the numbers guy. It was good to hear yesterday the support we received from Senator Hannon, Chairman Phil Lang, and from Mayor Drake of Beaverton in regards to agents' compensation and looking and increasing that agent compensation. As Marshall has stated, we have two objectives: increasing the agent's compensation to 9.5, along with building some type of an incentive plan, and moving agent's compensation sales incentive plan to a non-limited expense item. Now to the point, and you may be asking, why am I here asking for more compensation to agents? And hopefully I can answer some questions and give some statistical data that's information that I think is needed. Some key factors have to be reviewed over the last 10, 11 years. A lot of this is known. Overall, agents' compensation as a percentage has increased 4%. So in 1992, if it was $10, it's now $10.40. 11 years, 40 cents. If you look at Oregon minimum wage, it's up 45% in that same period. Portland General Electric, PGE, they've increased 52%, and it appears we'll have maybe another 16% increase this summer. Inflation rate has been approximately 2.5 in the last 11 years. 11 years ago, agents were not paying for bags. We pay for them today. My cost in my store runs between $350 and $500 a month. Commercial property expenses have really gone up, whether we lease it, own it, or rent it. In my store, it goes up 5% every year according to my lease. And that's not uncommon in a leased facility. This list continues. Wages to our employees are far above the minimum wage. Medical insurances in the last 6 or 7 years have almost doubled. Business insurance costs have gone up substantially. Most of this information, I'm sure, is known to you. When you combine these real cost increases with OLCC expectations and, as an agent, my expectations of having a clean, bright, safe sales environment for my customers, to have well-trained and knowledgeable staff, a well-stocked store with few outages, inventory controlled via basically a good computer system, providing excellent customer service, understanding the laws regarding selling to minors, selling to very intoxicated persons, cash management, not only my cash, but the state's cash, which crosses my hand almost every day, security for not only my cash, but your cash and product in my store, opening more days, Sundays and holidays, opening longer hours to give my customers a better shopping environment and more convenient to them, better locations with good visibility in a strip mall, in a good location, not on the backside, That costs more money. When you combine all these expectations placed on agents, along with the real costs that we've seen, I think you understand that we've carried a heavy load for a long mile. And I think Chairman Butler said it, we need to get more water to the end of the row. I have lots of data from stores, from my store. If you have questions for me, I will gladly try and answer them. I'd like to kind of now turn this back over to Vance, who is a fellow agent at the 10th Avenue Liquor Store.
Thank you very much, George. We'll come back with questions. Vance, we're eating seriously into your rotary hour here, so we'll go ahead and...
I'll make it quick. Chairman Lang, members of the committee, my name is Vance Burkhardt. I am a liquor agent. I operate the 10th Avenue Liquor Store located in downtown Portland. George just outlined to you, and so did Marshall, our needs for increased funding. Liquor agents are participating members of the OLCC, and we share many of their goals to upgrade our stores, provide better customer service, and a more consumer-friendly shopping atmosphere. The OLCC staff has outlined earlier this week their wishes to continue to upgrade our stores and place stores in better retail locations, providing us better service. These changes not only will increase revenue to the state, but it will also have the potential of increasing revenue to liquor agents. However, upgrading to accomplish these changes requires more funding than we are currently receiving. Providing agents with a compensation rate of 9.5% will go a long way to facilitate the upgrading of these services and facilities. Currently, our operational costs are increasing at a faster rate than our compensation. Many agents have been able to deal with these increased costs by working longer hours themselves, reducing hours of operation, operating with limited and minimal staff, and by suspending facility repairs and upgrades. All of these concessions are reducing our sales, and they're reducing income to the state. During this fiscal biennium, I've deposited about $8 million into the state treasury, and it could have been more. If it was economically feasible for me, I'd be open more than the 8-hour minimum that I am. I would consider opening on Sundays. I would operate with more than the minimal sales staff that I am, and I would convert my store from a counter service store to a self-service store. Many of my fellow agents have indicated that they would follow a similar path with additional funding. At our current 8.54% commission, the return on my expense dollars just don't justify making these changes. You've all heard the phrase that it takes money to make money, and this is as true in the state's liquor monopoly as it is in any other business environment. By increasing agents' compensation by less than 1%, my fellow agents and I believe that there would be a substantial dollar return to the state's general fund, and at the same time, Oregon's liquor control system can continue to safely, economically, and effectively distribute distilled spirits to our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the two liquor agents, how many employees do each one of you have?
At my store in Milwaukee, I have 6 employees. They're all part-time. 2 of them are near full-time. The other 4 are at about 25 to 30 hours a week.
And you?
I have 3 full-time. I had 3 part-time. I'm now down to 1 part-time because of some funding problems.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please follow up, Representative.
Do you provide medical coverage for your employees?
I do not.
I provide it for 1.
I had a question relative to the computer system. George, you referred to it. I assume you both have computer systems, point-of-sale software.
Correct.
Tell me how that ties together with the existing software of the OLCC. Do you do your ordering? Does it facilitate?
We both have the same system, so...
and I think my response is probably poorly. That they commingle information together. At the first of this month and at the first of every month, we're supposed to send in our ending inventory. And I did that on a Saturday morning. And I believe Saturday was the first of the month, so I sent my inventory into the OLCC. And it goes
is that
across.
By email or?
Electronically.
Okay.
By not email, but electronically.
Their computer's running on Saturday morning.
Mine was. When I sent mine in, I know I sent it. And Sunday, I came back in on the 2nd, and I placed an electronic order for product for the following Wednesday to come to my store. And then I found out that there was no one there Saturday, and in fact, I know my information got there, but however, it overlapped, so they lost my inventory. They didn't have it at the end of the month. I had to again resend it. So if everything works right, yes, I can communicate with them, but if there's any glitch, then there is a problem. And it is a POS system. I know how many bottles I sell today. I know how many I've sold for this month. I can look back at the last 12 months and see what my sales for each product, whether it's a little bottle to a half gallon. So it's an extensive POS system that serves me extremely well.
And is your computer, why does your computer write over the information at the office of the OLCC?
Go ahead, Vance.
Our files are sent in just a file bundle. It sends it to theirs. It sits in another file for store 200, per se. As long as they pull that information off prior to your sending more information to them, you're okay. However, it's sitting there, and if you send an order in on top of your inventory, if they have not pulled that out of there, it overwrites the file.
And there's no way that their computer communicates with your computer that it's received and processed the information?
Normally, normally in a situation like George was talking about, I will call their IT department and ask them, did you pull my file off? Can I send my order?
Are they typically open on weekends?
No one is in the office. No, the computers are supposed to be on and operational.
And so, if the computer is on and operational, it'll receive that. But if you send it in on Saturday, then you can't send an order on Sunday. And
correct.
Okay. All right. You represent 107 agents, which is nearly something close to approaching half of the agents out there.
Correct.
Do we know anything from your 105 other agents? What their systems do, how they communicate, what the platforms are that they're using.
Representative Butler, all agents use the same file transfer protocols to send the information to the OLCC computers for those who have computers. There is a different system that requires, I really do not understand it because I've never used it, but it's a file system where they mark on a piece of paper what their inventory is, and then they mail that to the OLCC. I do not know what the percentages are. I believe it's mostly the smaller stores in outlying rural areas.
Okay. Are there further questions for Mr. Koba and the agents? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marshall, at your convenience, I would be curious to know the number of employees in the stores and how many of them provide any kind of medical coverage for their employees.
Certainly. We'll get that.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'm sorry. Senator, did you have a question?
Yes, I do.
Please.
Because in addition to the information of how much medical coverage is provided, also, what's the average wage?
Marshall, if you'll gather that and get it back, we'd appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Pam, Director, former Director Erickson, immediate past Director, Pam Erickson, now with Oregon Partnership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pamela Erickson. I'm director of the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking, a project under the Oregon Partnership. I'm here representing Judy Cushing, who wanted to be here today and deliver this testimony, but she called this morning and said that she'd pretty much lost her voice, so she wouldn't be able to do it. So I'm sitting in for Ms. Cushing. The Oregon Partnership is one of Oregon's premier prevention organizations. Our job is to help prevent alcohol and drug problems, particularly with Oregon's youth. And it is my pleasure to be here to support the budget of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The OLCC's job is to enforce Oregon's excellent alcohol laws. Study after study has shown that good enforcement is vital to keeping the public safe from problems with alcohol. The OLCC is doing a very effective job with exceptionally limited resources. We must maintain and enhance those resources. Underage drinking is Oregon's most serious alcohol problem. Oregon's children are drinking at earlier and earlier ages. And it's shocking to know that 1 out of 4 eighth graders in this state reports drinking in the last month. A landmark study found that if a child begins drinking before age 15, their chances of being an addict as an adult are 10 times greater than if they waited until 21. More recently, studies have documented that childhood drinking creates damage within the brain, affects learning ability and critical reasoning skills. And parents who have teens in college need to know that failure in college is highly related to heavy drinking. I could go on and cite a lot of other statistics about the connection between alcohol and the leading cause of death for our children. However, the primary message is that we need to make progress on this problem or we will lose many of our young people. I just returned from the 13th Annual Alcohol Policy Conference. Judy and I attended this conference. It's given every 2 years. It's a wonderful conference that has all of the recent research on what works on alcohol prevention. And again, they reiterated the vital importance of enforcing our good alcohol laws. Oregon probably has the best set of alcohol laws in the nation, but they're only as good as their enforcement. For underage drinking, compliance checks are exceptionally important. So important that the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation recommends that they be the first priority for liquor law enforcement. They also note that these checks need to be fair and reasonable. Not only does the OLCC do them in a very fair manner, but they've been enhanced by a lot of other programs. One of those is the Responsible Vendor Program that the legislature passed several years ago. Recently, a free videotape has been developed for retailers so they can train their employees. It's being translated into Korean and Spanish. We're also working on, together with our other partners, in enhancing this program so we can really be of assistance to retailers so that they can do the vital job we need to have them do. It's just that the lack of resources is very difficult for OLCC and the partner law enforcement agencies to frequently check the over 10,000 licensees in the state. In conclusion, I urge that you continue to maintain all current resources for enforcement and look for additional resources to combat underage drinking. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pam. It's great to have you back. Are there questions for Ms. Erickson? And just one item. I read a study in a magazine called NATO, N-A-T-O, dealing with tobacco issues and the concern that the increase in the price of tobacco creates erstwhile opportunities to buy backstreet tobacco, and those folks that are selling out of the trunks of cars are not going to be concerned whether or not you're ID'd. If we increase, now you see where I'm coming from here, if we increase the price of alcohol in the state of Oregon, and whether that's a beer tax or wine tax or additional price on hard liquor, are we going to create a larger tap out business that might produce additional consumption by underage drinkers, or will it offset, does the higher prices offset that additional numbers of youth that might have otherwise had access to alcohol?
Mr. Chairman, there are only, I believe, 3 states that have a lower tax on beer than Oregon. Studies have shown that beer is the beverage of choice for our underage drinkers. That's the typical beverage that they drink. And it's inconceivable to me that we would raise the tax so high that it would generate an illegal alcohol business. Even if we added 10 cents, we're not going to get still not going to get very high. And it may be that if such a tax were to pass, it might be a lot less. We have such a long ways to go to be even at the national average that I just don't see that happening.
Okay. That's valid. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Pam. Thank you very much. And Officer John Laws, Portland Police Bureau.
Good morning. I'm Officer John Laws of the Portland Police Bureau. First of all, I'm going to say don't let this pile. These are just crime reports for a couple days from the north half of the city of Portland related to alcohol. And I was back there doing some work with them. I am John Laws of the Portland Police Bureau, and I'm currently assigned to our Drug and Vice Division as a liquor license establishment investigator. I'm one of two for the city of Portland has dedicated to liquor license establishments. I'm here today as a representative of our Chief of Police, Mark Croker. And I'm here to address the effects on the City of Portland of the proposed cuts of 15 and a half full-time employee positions within the OLCC. It's our understanding that included in the 15 and a half full-time employee positions are 11 in the regulatory program, and four of these positions are licensed investigators. Which represents about 20% of the statewide OLCC licensed investigator workforce. And two of these positions also include a manager and support person for these for the licensed investigator positions. These licensed investigators are involved in enforcing compliance with both Oregon Rights statutes passed by this legislative body and the Oregon administrative rules put in place by the Liquor Commission headed by person this wing is named after, Philip Lang. The regulatory staff of OLCC is the direct interface with the City of Portland's Office of Neighborhood Involvement, with the actual neighborhood associations, and of course the police. We work in partnership with OLCC in dealing with these issues, such as the immediate liquor license suspensions, street drinking issues, unlawful activity at liquor license establishments, and neighborhood livability issues. The elimination of these positions will reduce the effectiveness and our effectiveness in dealing with these problems. We recognize the fiscal problems facing the state today. These positions are funded through the taxes on the liquor sales, and we strongly urge you to maintain these regulatory positions. Do I have any questions?
Any questions of Officer Laws? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And last on our list, but not least, Paul Cosgrove and Hasina Squires.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing DISCUS. And since my client's name is an acronym, I have to put my name in.
Thank you very much.
Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, along with Hasina's client, Hood River Distillery, represent most of the manufacturers and importers of products sold at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission stores. I will be very brief and make just a couple of points because I just want to reemphasize our support for some of the things you've heard both yesterday and today. First, as you well know, this is the state's largest retailing and wholesaling operation, by far exceeding anything that the state tries to operate in any other venue, and therefore it's a unique agency. And it's an agency where the sales of distilled spirits not only contribute greatly to the funds available to you for general governmental purposes and to the cities and counties, but in fact they fund all of the enforcement and regulatory operations of the agency. The beer and wine tax goes into distribution out to the cities, counties, and the general fund, but the profits from the sale of distilled spirits is what fund everything in the Milwaukee headquarters, not just the warehouse operations that directly relate to the sale of distilled spirits, but that portion that isn't paid by licensing fees. Excuse me, there is a licensing fee component, but that's a relatively small component, as you know, in the budget. Everything else that happens in Milwaukee is paid for these. So how we operate that system affects not only the availability of the legislature to appropriate that money for general government purposes, but also affects how the agency can reach its other goals of reducing underage drinking and sales to visibly intoxicated persons. there's been some discussion about marketing, and what we would like to propose is that the real marketing that occurs in this data needs to occur is the marketing that happens in individual agents' stores. The rulemaking that Karen Gregory mentioned to you earlier this morning that's pending on marketing rules, in fact, was initiated by one of the distillery brokers who works with our industry to try to free up some of the antiquated rules and restrictions on what liquor agents can do. But the real need for liquor agents to be able to do that marketing and provide that customer service is to be adequately compensated. And we try not to use the term agents' compensation, because although you know very well that that isn't money that's going into agents' pockets, it's money that's going for rent and salaries and store operations. I think that term has been confused in the building at large, and it's assumed that that's money that just goes into these agents' pockets as salary. We prefer to call that operational line item store operations, because that's what it is. It's currently 8.54% of more than half a billion dollar system is spent on the retail side of the store operations. In the governor's task force, and I know that Representative Johnson served on it, and you've seen the report, there were representatives of other retail operations, and one in particular, Representative Plaid Pantry, when he heard how we fund store operations, the retail operations of this major retail system, he was, I think, surprised. His comment was, I couldn't operate a store on 8.54%. I don't see how these folks can. So although we understand the concerns in the building about financial issues, this is the money-generating part of this agency, and we think that unless there's sufficient investment in that, the agents can't continue to do what they've been doing for years, which is, with proportionately less and less money, doing a better and better job responsibly selling to drinkers in this state distilled spirits. We strongly support the agent's proposal to increase their base compensation to 9.5%, and also to make it an unlimited expenditure so that they can know with some certainty that if they perform in the way they perform responsibly selling these products, that the compensation will be there for them. I just make a point that the agents have already done their part in terms of the projections before you in this budget. The agency has projected an 8% increase in the total sales of distilled spirits from the last biennium to this biennium. In fact, agents are already ahead of their last biennial projections substantially this year, so they've already started to make their commitments to make those sales. What we have done in this budget, unfortunately, is essentially taken all those extra profits and moved them, or proposed to move them elsewhere. We would suggest that some of those additional profits the state will receive in this biennium need to be rooted back into the reasonable support of the retail store operations. I would be happy to answer any questions. I'd just like to close by saying I've been working with Discus for a number of sessions, and I think it's an unusual, and I know some of you have been aware of these issues as well, I think it's unusual to find here that you have really all of the interested parties coming before you on this issue of store operations or agents' compensation. You have the agency in terms of the testimony that Chair Lang gave you yesterday. You have the public in terms of Mayor Drake with the task force. You have the distillery industry represented by Hasina and me here, and you have the agents themselves. And that has not been the normal case of affairs with this budget in years past. We've tried to work hard together and to come to you with a joint proposal. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Hasina?
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, here today, Hasina Squires on behalf of Hood River Distillers, a company established in 1934. The Northwest largest and oldest importer and producer of distilled spirits. Currently, when you see, typically, here it comes, Representative Butler, a bottle of HRD vodka. That's what it is. I have to use that because lots of people remember that from their college days or high school days.
Not high school.
No, really not high school. and many other people currently continue to purchase those products. Currently, one out of every four bottles sold in Oregon is an HRD brand bottle. They also market under 40 labels of Monarch products. Mr. Cosgrove has done an excellent job of summarizing all of the salient points with respect to the whole agent compensation store operations issue. The CEO of, I need to get another dollar, CEO of Hood River Distillers did participate in the governor's alcohol beverage task force very willingly and very diligently, and strongly supports the recommendations of that task force, particularly the one suggesting an increase in agent compensation. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, are there questions for Mr. Cosgrove or Ms. Squire? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes the list of the folks that have signed up to testify during the public hearing. We will have a work session at some point after the chair, the co-chair's budgets have been published. I think they're shooting for mid-April right now. I will reserve and hold open, however, an opportunity for us to come back to this issue for additional public hearing, probably with regard to the outstanding bills. And I would like to charge Karen and John Steubenville to please plan to come back so that we can get some idea of the actual costs of the licensure to produce the licenses and to both take care of renewals as well as new licenses on a one-year and on a two-year renewal arrangement. And I think we've discovered that there is a bill that we can continue to work that with and work towards that that would continue to assist us then with the additional revenues that we may need to make sure that we can address the issues that were so appropriately discussed by Carol Reese and Marjorie Taylor earlier, as well as others who are concerned about the regulatory process. So if you folks will continue to work on that, and then if you'll get back in touch when you're ready to sit down and let us know, and then where those bills are, please, Karen and John, so we can start to work on that to try and get amendments to those to address all of the issues. I think that's a pay-as-you-go system certainly makes sense in this type of environment, and I don't think anyone that's applying for licensure in the state of Oregon is asking us to subsidize that from the general funds. They would, I think, particularly for the services and the good service. And I want to reiterate what I found that Ms. Botkins had discussed earlier, and that is, in working with the OLCC, they really understand the importance of making sure that licensure is current and that they're on top of it, because they know that if you're not able to sell, then they're not able to bring the income in for the state, and they feel like it's a very personal responsibility. And that's why I say I appreciate the comments from the staff of the OLCC. So with that, if there's nothing further, next week we will pick up Monday through Thursday the four advocacy commissions, and we will have full hearings on the advocacy commissions, doing public hearings on those folks. With that, we will stand adjourned until Monday at 8:30. Thank you.